After appearing as a character in two nonfiction books about the rock and roll industry written by other people, Danny Goldberg has decided to tell his own story in a new memoir for Gotham Books called Bumping Into Geniuses. But in the process, he's also telling a lot of other people's stories. Danny Goldberg ran Atlantic, Mercury, and Warner Brothers Records, and so Patti Smith, Warren Zevon, Bruce Springsteen, Kurt Cobain, Nirvana, Bonnie Raitt, Steve Earle, Led Zeppelin all show up as characters in his book. I'm really pleased that he could come by to share some of his many stories with us today. Hi.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me on.
And you start off your book with the late Jerry Wexler, who was then the president of Atlantic Records, growling at you, "There are no secrets." What did he mean by that?
Well, I had met him for the first time. I was 19, and he had asked his press person to put a bunch of young rock critics together so he could meet them. And I asked him if he was going to go to one of those conferences. He says, "I never go to those things. There are no secrets." Firstly, the premise is that you go there to learn secrets, and there are no secrets. And by the way, if there were any secrets, we would never tell you what they are. So,
someone in the business once told me that if someone sneezes in New York, someone in Los Angeles says Gesundheit.
Well,
which was saying that everybody knows everything.
I think that's right. And the mythology of the business was that there was someone you could bribe to make a record successful. And the reality is that people had to like it first for the bribes to be effective. And
you're not
finding
saying,
something.
You're not saying there isn't payola. You're
no,
just saying,
I'm saying payola was how you mainstreamed and broadened out something. Or getting a favor or whatever it was. But at the core of it was discovering and observing the unpredictable and magic interaction between a piece of music and an audience. And you couldn't make that happen. You just have to – you had to find it happening and then try to spread it out. And finding it is a lot harder than spreading it.
Well, I suspect that you had any number of times when you thought this artist is just great or this recording is just great and you believed in it and – nothing happened.
Yeah, well, I started as sort of as a wannabe rock critic. I never was great at it, but a lot of the artists that I loved the most, Alan Wainwright III and the MC5, never got the mass audience, even though I thought they were amazing. And there were people to this day, they're really successful that to me I think are kind of mediocre, but they have kind of a commercial talent. And really, the more you're in the business, the more you learn to honor the actual reaction of parts of the public to music, and then you try to mainstream and spread that. But if you think you can make people like a piece of music, you're delusional. And that's where the title comes from, really, is David Geffen had asked Ahmet Erdogan, "How do I get rich?" when he was a young man. And Ahmet said, "The way to get rich in the music business is keep wandering around until you bump into a genius, and when you do, hold on and don't let go."
And Geffen took his advice.
He did, and he found Neil Young and Laura Nyro and the Eagles and went far with those geniuses.
And you say one non-secret is that no one became a rock star by accident or against their will. Now, the fans would like to believe that there's a certain amount of integrity, and some people lose their integrity. After all, when Bob Dylan went electric, many people felt betrayed. You talk about being really surprised when you heard Bruce Springsteen mention demographics.
Right. Well, I don't pretend to know Springsteen that well, but I did work with him on a documentary called No Nukes that was came out in 1980 that was to raise consciousness about the environmental hazards of nuclear power. And we were in an editing room, and this was after Darkness on the Edge of Town had come out. And he was saying, I realized that I talked to this consultant, Cal Rudman, and he said that I don't have good female demographics, you know, and to have a pop hit, you have to have girls. And the new record, I'm going to write a song for girls. And sure enough, on the new record, he wrote Hungry Heart, which did indeed become his first pop hit. It had harmonies by the Turtles and a sped-up vocal and a more romantic lyric. And at first, I thought, wow, this is a shock to hear him say the word demographic. But really, why wouldn't he want to reach the biggest possible audience? And rock and roll, from its origins, was a combination of art and business. It wasn't like a pure art form like folk music or jazz or classical music. It from its very genetic code involved having hits and reaching the masses. But people who practiced that commercial form, some of them were great artists. And the hybrid produced things like Dylan and the Beatles and the Stones and I believe Nirvana and other people. And the exciting thing to me was that that rock and roll could reach people that beatniks never could reach. You know, and I think Allen Ginsberg, who I was lucky enough to meet in his latter years of his life, loved Bob Dylan for that reason, that he knew Bob Dylan could reach people that he could never reach with a certain type of psychic energy.
It's my sense that the history of rock music has been, it starts off very basic, and then somewhere down the line, people start thinking about making art, and it gets more and more rarefied. And then there is this break, and we go back to basics, whether it's the MC5 or whatever. And then that takes over for a while, and then that starts becoming art again. And then somebody else comes along and goes back to basics. And it's always been that way.
Well, popular music operates in a context, and one of the main contexts it operates in is high school. And I think people in high school always want something different from people 4 or 5 years older than them. And so something that's very hip 1 year becomes very passe a few years later. And the need for each generation to differentiate from people a few years older than them keeps forcing that kind of a change for it to be meaningful to audiences.
My guest is Danny Goldberg. He's written a memoir called Bumping Into Geniuses, My Life Inside the Rock and Roll Business, published by Gotham Books. How did you go from being a critic to becoming an executive? You pretty much started at the bottom, didn't you?
I started as a clerk. I was 18. I got a job at Billboard through an ad in the New York Times. It was a clerical job that turned out to be one of the people calling record stores and to gather information from which they made the charts. At the time, I didn't know that there was such a thing as the music business.
You worked for Billboard?
My first job was working for Billboard, and then I found out there were people getting paid money to write their opinions of rock concerts. And even though I had low self-esteem, I knew I could do that. And I was reviewed the Woodstock Festival for them because none of the older writers wanted to schlep up there. But I found that I was more of a fan than a critic, that I was never really a good critic because I loved the people I loved, but I didn't like to badmouth the people I didn't. I felt guilty if I criticized, Stephen Stills or somebody. And so I did what a lot of unsuccessful journalists do. I got a job in PR, and I turned out to be a good PR guy, and I did publicity for Led Zeppelin, and that kind of opened a lot of doors for me.
But being a fan can be a problem, can't it? Because you do have to maintain a certain amount of objectivity. You do have to sometimes not, push something that you don't particularly love, but you know is going to be a big success. After all, it's also a business.
It is a business, and you have to make a living, and that's certainly but I think that for me, being a fan certainly helped me with a lot of artists, and I think that you can get into a kind of a mindset where you look for what's good in something and find, when I started as a PR person, you're exactly right, I had to take whatever clients were put on my desk by my boss. Over the course of time, I was able to select the people I worked with, and that's a little more fun.
How accurate were the portraits of you in the books Hammer of the Gods and Come As You Are?
Hammer of the Gods I thought was pretty accurate. My friend Stephen Davis wrote that, and I was happy to be included in it, and I thought it was accurate as far as it went. Obviously, it wasn't about me as much as about the members of Led Zeppelin. And I don't remember having any problems with the way I was described in Come As You Are, although I haven't picked it up as recently. So I was pretty happy with the way I was treated in both of those books.
Well, they say that people in the business, when a new book comes out, they look at the index, they find their name, they say, oh, this is great, or this is a piece of junk, and then they don't look at the rest of the book.
Well, I don't think that's only people in show business. I think people in politics do that too, and I think it's a human. I mean, even books that I do read, I'll still look for my name in the index first. It's hard to resist if you've got an ego like most of us do.
But is that one of the reasons you decided to write your memoir, to set the record straight?
No, I did it just – I kind of walked around with the idea of a book in my head most of my life. I was one of those kids that always thought I was going to – my life was worth a book. And there just was a moment when my professional life was kind of going slow. I was in between things, and I just – finally decided to start doing it. And once I started doing it, it was fun to do. But it's really a love letter to rock and roll. I'm not trying to settle any scores. I think there's some sex and drugs in there, and I think there's some stories that people like if they're fans of Led Zeppelin or Stevie Nicks or Patti Smith or Nirvana or some of the others, Warren Zevon. But it's really mostly a love letter to the business that gave me a place in the world.
How accurate was a film like This Is Spinal Tap?
Well, it's pretty funny. I know a lot of artists that saw Spinal Tap and came out of it depressed instead of laughing because it was a little too close to reality. It's a brilliant satire of the business that I think everybody in the business loves Spinal Tap.
You said that this is really a love letter. In fact, you defend all sorts of people against the kind of stuff that is done to them, including Jerry Wexler, who was a key figure in the music business. You felt that he wasn't done justice by the portrayal of him in the film Ray.
Well, he wasn't. Of course, I understand the film Ray was about Ray Charles, and I think Taylor Hackford had a focus on Ray Charles, and Jamie Foxx did this amazing job of bringing to life Ray Charles, and the executives were secondary figures. But in real life, both Ahmet Erdogan and Jerry Wexler were larger-than-life, robust, powerful people that filled up a room and were the center of attention even when artists were in the room. And that's not – and you know, in the film, they were kind of nerdy. Mm-hmm. So I don't blame the actors or the filmmaker. They had to make that movie. But Jerry Wexler in real life was like an Old Testament prophet with these sunken eyes and this intense intellect. And Ahmet Erdogan was this elegant figure that everybody – the artists wanted to get his approval, not the way the other way around. But that wasn't the job of the Ray movie.
Although there have been any number of films about – the rock and roll business, where the record company owners are these rapacious, horrible people destroying these idealistic young artists who have a message to get across.
Well, there were definitely dishonest people at record companies, many of whom stole money or tricked artists into making less money than they could have or should have gotten. I mean, there's no question that happened.
Especially
as the years went by, exactly, as the years went by and artists became more powerful, it's kind of like professional sports where the performers over the course of time developed representatives and developed the power because of their fan base to negotiate far better deals and get much more control both artistically, where at a fairly early stage rock artists were able to negotiate creative control and financially. But it was a hard-won struggle, and even today there are bad actors in the business who mistreat artists. But in general, rock artists coming out of the late 60s developed a lot of power, a lot more power than other creative people had relative to their businesses.
There's some bad actors on the other side. I have to tell you that Gene Simmons was one of the most obnoxious guests I've ever had on the show. You say that you saw quite a different side of him thanks to his mother. Well, his mother didn't come along, unfortunately, when he was a guest.
You know, it is unfortunate. I know he has an obnoxious side to him. I have to say he's been a good friend to me over the years, and I quite like him a lot. And he was very generous with his time when I was writing the book. But he has a irritating, bellicose side to him. I also, as a bleeding heart liberal, I hate the fact that he's become this sort of neocon supporter of Bush and McCain. But notwithstanding that, I do like him, and I found him a good guy to work with.
Did Led Zeppelin mark the turning point in your career?
Yes,
because you suddenly connect yourself to. You could have successes, but then there's success in success.
Oh, sure. Prior to that, I was kind of a second-rate journalist and a second-rate PR guy. I was young enough that it was okay to be second-rate. But proximity to Led Zeppelin when they were at the peak of their career gave me entree and opened doors. And to this day, 35 years later, I still can dine out telling Led Zeppelin stories to people. That was absolutely the big transformative moment for my career.
And then you also had Kurt Cobain. Now, I mean, I don't know whether he was a depressive or whether it was just the drugs that are so prevalent in the rock world that destroyed people like him and played havoc with a lot of careers, including Led Zeppelin.
Well, I'm not a fan of drug abuse, and I was lucky enough to get that out of my system before I got into the business. But a lot of people take drugs and don't kill themselves. So clearly, I think it was a combination. I think he had a tough childhood. I think he was kind of clinically depressed. I think drug abuse exacerbated it, and it's a great loss to anybody who knew him and to his fans. But you know, a lot of people take drugs and don't kill themselves.
We have very little time, but you have a company called Gold Village Entertainment, and some people are predicting the end of the music business as we've known it because so many listeners are getting their music free on the internet. What's your feeling on
that? Well, the record business, as we've known it, is permanently changed and reduced. Happily, there's another part of the music business, which is concerts. And if you want to go to a concert, you got to pay because a big guy won't let you in otherwise. So there's still a music business. It's just a little smaller.
Danny Goldberg's book, Bumping Into Geniuses, My Life Outside the Rock and Roll, Inside the Rock and Roll Business. It's been my life outside of it. It's published by Gotham Books. Thank you so much for coming by.
Thank you so much for having me on, Leonard. I really appreciate it. Gambling in Havana, I took a little risk. Send lawyers, guns, and money. Dad, get me out of this. Ha! I'm the innocent bystander.